There is Fresh Start versus Astor.
Do you have a preference for appellant and respondent on the sides?
You choose wherever you would like. We won't dock you.
I'll be splitting my time with my co-counsel. We will each take 4 minutes and then reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
So opening will be 4 minutes each and then 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay, so please identify yourself for the record.
May it please the court, my name is Alex Strong, and along with my co-counsel, Esdras Rivera, I represent Fresh Start in this appeal. Now, in this case, what we have are the Astors trying to go back on a contract that they signed, a contract the trial court found was clearly labeled. Now, at trial, the Astors argued that the warranty deed that they signed to Fresh Start was actually an equitable mortgage, and the trial court ruled that way. But the trial court erred because it fundamentally misunderstood the concept of a mortgage. A mortgage is a conveyance of title to property that is given as security for the payment of a debt or the performance of a duty. Now, in this case, in finding of fact 5, the trial court specifically found that there was no new note or any other evidence of new indebtedness. Fresh Start paid the Astors $50,000.
Could you address how you get around finding number 6?
So, because it's not an equitable mortgage, the trial court erred in considering extrinsic evidence of intent outside the written terms of the contract.
Well, as I understand it, the court found that the parties did not intend the warranty deed to convey absolute title. Is it your position there needs to be some ambiguity in that deed before the court consider the party's intent?
Well, when a party argues that a deed is in fact an equitable mortgage, the court is allowed to consider extrinsic intent. However, here, there is no debt, so there is no debt to secure for a mortgage. The title was not conveyed for the purpose, couldn't have been conveyed for the purpose of securing a debt because there was no debt to begin with.
Okay, what would you have this court say to the trial court about its finding that the parties did not intend to convey absolute title?
That it erred in considering extrinsic evidence of intent outside the bounds of the contract when it couldn't be an equitable mortgage because of the lack of debt.
Did the contract, as you just used that word, exclude the possibility that the court could consider outside evidence?
The record is not developed on that point. But it did clearly make a purchase and sale agreement. All the documents were clearly labeled. It was an unambiguous transfer of title. And there's no debt in this case. A mortgage.
Are you saying that if we have a real estate transaction and there is no promissory note, then we can't consider extrinsic evidence regarding the intent of the document of conveyance?
Well, not only is there no promissory note, the trial court made a specific finding there was absolutely no evidence of any indebtedness to Fresh Start. So the promissory note.
But didn't Fresh Start loan the Astors $50,000?
They didn't loan them the money. The Astors were not required to repay the $50,000. There was no debt between the Astors just did not owe Fresh Start any money. And so because of that, the respondents are arguing that you have to look at the series of Pitwood factors, the four factors our Supreme Court mentioned in Pitwood. But if you look at those factors, all of them presuppose a creditor-debtor relationship, which there isn't in this case because the Astors don't owe Fresh Start any money. One of the factors is
they at least owe them rent.
Sorry?
They at least owe rent.
They owe them rent, yes, under the lease agreement. They owe them rent, but they do not owe them the $50,000 that was paid for the property.
What did the option to repurchase require them to pay in order to obtain the property?
You may answer.
The record is not clear on that point. Thank you.
Okay. You used your first 4 minutes.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. As my co-counsel mentioned, my name is Esdras Rivera, and I represent Fresh Start, and I'm here to talk about the CPA claim. We believe that the trial court properly dismissed the CPA claim. The respondents contend that the trial court used the improper standard of whether or not it had the capacity to deceive as opposed to actual deception. And as my co-counsel previously mentioned, all the documents were clearly marked. They were clearly labeled. There would be no capacity to deceive if everything is clearly labeled and marked. The Astors, while they did not discuss the terms of the actual contract, they agreed that the terms were fair and reasonable.
Should the trial court have even considered the Consumer Protection Act claim?
I do not believe that they should have. I don't believe that they had jurisdiction to consider that. The initial claim or the initial suit started as an unlawful detainer action, which is one of limited jurisdiction. And the CPA does not grant general jurisdiction, so they would be only restricted or limited to the question of whether or not the Astors had title. With regards to the actual contract, the fact that they did not discuss it and ignorance of the actual contents of the contract by the person signing it does not affect their liability, as stated in State versus Chase. The court also held in Tijart versus Smith that a party to a contract is conclusively presumed to know what is in the contract and what they are signing. And we believe that an ordinary consumer would be able to recognize what the documents were, and given that they were clearly marked and identified, and know what they were signing. And we believe that it was clear to the Astors, as my co-counsel mentioned, that Fresh Start was purchasing the property and there was no loan for the property.
Is there anything in the record that provides evidence of the fair market value of this property versus the amount Fresh Start paid?
The record on that point is fairly limited. What we do know is that the Astors considered the market value of $50,000 from Fresh Start to be fair and reasonable based on their financial insolvency and market conditions. And that's all the record states on that point. with regards also to the elements of the CPA claim, had the court even had jurisdiction, we believe that they failed to meet the elements of the CPA claim, as it were. So the trial court properly dismissed the CPA claim. For that reason, this court should affirm the trial court on the CPA as properly dismissed and quiet title to the Fresh Start. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you.
For time, can we split ours a little bit differently, please?
You can split your time, your 10 minutes, however you would like, but I can only do whole minutes.
Okay, I will take 6 minutes, please.
6 minutes for you, okay.
And four for my co-counsel.
That's correct. Okay.
May it please the court,
My name is Shona Volkers, and together with my co-counsel, Dustin Drangus, we represent respondents in this matter, John and Mary Astor. This court should affirm the trial court's ruling and hold that Fresh Start and the Astors entered an equitable mortgage for two reasons. First, the test for finding an equitable mortgage exists as a multi-factor analysis of what both parties intended. Second, the trial court correctly found that both Fresh Start and the Astors intended to create an equitable mortgage and for title to remain with the Astors.
Their biggest argument seems to be that there is no debt. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. As the Washington Supreme Court held in Pitwood v. Spokane in 1997, when determining whether a deed was a mortgage, we looked to four things, one of them being the express language of the contract, but also we looked to whether or not there was a debtor-creditor relationship created. We looked to the value of the property compared to the amount of indebtedness, and we look to the conduct surrounding the transaction by all parties.
Well, one of the arguments is that we should not look at extrinsic evidence. So how can we look at extrinsic evidence, which is encompassed in at least two of those factors?
Extrinsic evidence is appropriate when there is a mistake or ambiguity. And in this case, not only were some of the terms ambiguous, but there is a mistake, a fundamental mistake made on because of the vast difference of intent on the parties and understanding of what was going on. And so,
which terms are ambiguous?
The contract is ambiguous in a couple ways because it does not, the record shows that the contract did not expressly end the Astor's obligation to Big Bank, and nor the expressly put complete title in Fresh Start. For example,
typically, would a deed from one party to the other contain anything that terminated the grantor's obligation to a third party?
Yes, Your Honor, it would.
How do we know that?
We know that because in other cases that involve equitable mortgages, such as Pitwood v. Spokane or Redemptor's Fathers v. Purdy, that the court found a lack of intent because the express terms of the contract outlined that. And so that was one of the factors. And since this contract didn't expressly include that, that would point towards a lack of intent to transfer title.
Okay, normally, an equitable mortgage secures some kind of obligation from one party to another. What obligation would be secured here if this instrument was an equitable mortgage instead of a deed?
The obligation on the part of the Astors?
Yes.
The Astors were obligated to continue paying monthly payments to Fresh Start. Also, they took...
How long?
For at least... The contract here was specifically for a year, but they also had an option to pay the full amount. They also took on
when,
all the...
When you say the full amount, is that... What do you mean? Is that the...
Essentially to buy back the debt by...
The $50,000?
Right. Also, the incident...
The amount they would pay is the same 50 that was paid by Fresh Start?
I believe that is what the record reflects. Also, the incidence of ownership remained with the Astors, such as property taxes, increase in property taxes, or increase in home insurance, and all repairs to the property. And this goes to show intent on the part of Fresh Start, since they wrote these documents and their intent not to take on all these incidents of ownership. We also see Astors' intent to remain owners because, as the Washington Supreme Court held in Pitwood v. Spokane, a disparity between a value and price indicate that the property owner intended only to use their property as security. And in fact, that court held that this would necessarily lead to a conclusion because, not just because of common sense, but also because it would be
what evidence
against their interest.
Disparity.
$50,000 was significantly below the value of the home.
Well, but the home was subject to debt, correct?
Yes.
And if we subtract the debt from the fair market value, is there anything in the record that indicates that $50,000 is disproportionate to that number?
The record is not clear on that, Your Honor. So no. We also, this court should consider the conduct of the parties, and that in the original agreement between Fresh Start and the Astros, that they expressly hired Fresh Start to find a loan for them, and that is how Fresh Start set themselves out as a loan broker, not a home buyer. And so we see in the conduct surrounding the transaction, as well as the language of the documents and the disparity in price, that all of these taken that both parties intended to enter into equitable mortgage, and therefore the trial court was correct to find so. So therefore, this court should affirm the trial court's ruling and hold that there was an equitable mortgage and not a transfer of property. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And as I recall, you have 4 minutes.
That is correct. May it please the court, my name is Dustin Drengis. I'm here representing Mr. and Mrs. Astor in their CPA claim. I'm here to ask the court to reverse and remand to the trial court for further factual findings.
Why did the trial court have jurisdiction of the CPA claim in this unlawful detainer action?
The trial court had jurisdiction because it was in fact not an unlawful detainer action. As opposing counsel correctly pointed out, the unlawful detainer action is a very, very narrow proceeding. The unlawful detainer action is a summary proceeding designed to enable the recovery of possession of leased property. It's
well,
a proceeding.
Well, didn't you bring an? They brought the unlawful detainer. Then you counterclaimed, right?
Absolutely. So, Fresh Start brought their unlawful detainer claim. We had our claim of title. Once title is in dispute, it is no longer an unlawful detainer claim.
What case says that?
Proctor v. Forsyth, which was a Division One case. It was a very, very similar case to what we have here, where one party brought an unlawful detainer action. The defendant claimed title, that they had color of title. The trial court found in favor of the defendant, quieted title to the defendant. This court found that trial court that in that unlawful detainer action, they cannot quiet title.
Well, but did Proctor address a counterclaim for Consumer Protection Act?
Proctor did not address counterclaims for Consumer Protection.
So how is that related to, or is it related to an appropriate counterclaim in an unlawful detainer action?
So again, this was not an unlawful detainer action. Munden v. Hazelrig was a Washington State Supreme Court case holding that counterclaims cannot be brought unless based on facts which excuse tenants' breach.
Right.
You keep saying this isn't an unlawful.
This is not an unlawful detainer.
Okay, when plaintiff filed it, what kind of lawsuit did they file?
They filed an unlawful detainer action.
What makes it stop being an unlawful detainer action?
The trial court converted it to a general civil action by considering the...
Well, did the trial court enter an order that did that?
There is no evidence, there is no indication of this order. But the trial court...
Is it your argument that by considering the counterclaim on the merits, the trial court, without saying so, sub silento, converted it?
Both considering the counterclaim on its merits and quieting title. It was brought to the trial court's attention that unlawful, that they did not have jurisdiction.
What the trial court did was quiet title, and what the Court of Appeals said was you did too much. All you can say is that this is a defense. Your argument that this deed's invalid is a defense to the unlawful detainer action, but you got to go somewhere else to decide who actually owns the property. So how does that provide support for your argument?
The trial court is actually able to convert an unlawful detainer action into a general civil action claim, which is what they would have had to have done.
How does it do that?
It does that once it becomes clear that right to possession is no longer...
Not what is the justification, but procedurally, how does the trial court convert an action?
I do not. I'm not able to answer that specific question. So, in summary, the appellate court should reverse and remand back for factual findings on the consumer protection claim.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
The Astors mischaracterize the obligation, as they call it, that the Astors had towards Fresh Start. They were rental payments. It wasn't to secure the – they didn't have any debt towards Fresh Start.
Well, then why was there the option to buy back?
It was contracted for. That was part of the deal, and it was
– But it was to buy back their interest in the house, wasn't it?
Actually, so the record does not state – there's no evidence in the record that it is $450,000, that they would buy back the house for $50,000 or how much they would buy it back, just that they would have the option to repurchase along with their loan.
Well,
along with their lease. I misspoke, their lease. And speaking to the Pitwood factors, those factors presuppose a creditor-debtor relationship.
Isn't that just one of four factors?
Well, one of the factors is whether a creditor-debtor relationship continues to exist, and you can't consider whether it continues to exist if it was never formed in the first place.
Okay,
and also, you're supposed to compare the...
If you have three of the four factors present, what's the court supposed to do?
Well, I'm just saying you can't even weigh up some of those factors because there is no indebtedness in the first place. And the definition of it...
Doesn't the case that you're relying on say there are four factors you examine?
It says... And it also says that the most major consideration is indebtedness. In fact...
Any language in the opinion that says if one of the factors is absent, the trial court can't grant equitable mortgage relief?
It doesn't say that specifically, but the Astors haven't cited a single case in which a court has found an equitable mortgage when there hasn't been debt. The state has never found that, and so we ask that the trial court, we ask that this court reverse and quiet title in the Astors and affirm the CPA dismissal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. That concludes the arguments.